All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Our guest today, storyteller and scholar of mythology, Michael Mead, writes, "When life has become severely polarized, when people become alienated and isolated from each other, it is soul that has gone missing." He goes on to say, "This is not only true at an individual level, but also at the level of community and culture. Soul is a primordial and primary source of meaningful change in true transformation. This time of collective upheaval and cultural loss is also the time of a struggle for the presence of the human soul and a battle for the soul of the world." These are strong yet encouraging words today, and we'll be exploring the unique inner territories of the heart and soul and how the realm of imagination and dreams can renew us as well as help sustain life on our precious planet. Michael Mead is a renowned storyteller, author, scholar of mythology, and student of ritual in traditional cultures. He has scoured the world to bring us meaningful folktales that tap into ancestral sources of wisdom and acts as a guide to connect them to the stories we are living today. Mead is the founder of Mosaic Multicultural Foundation. He also distributes regular podcasts, and his many books include The Genius Myth, Why the World Doesn't End, Tales of Renewal in Times of Loss, Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements of the Soul, and Awakening the Soul, A Deep Response to a Troubled World. Join us for the next hour as we explore the awakening of soul in critical times with our guest, Michael Mead. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Michael, welcome.
Good to be back with you, Justine.
It's just grand to sit across from you once more. I always enjoy it. You bring some folktale or some myth, and it just like opens up the perspective, a larger view. I'm always excited to be with you. And it really is about the work of New Dimensions. That's what we try to do here. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about one of the myths that you really delve into in the very early part of the book. It's the world-weary man. And it's an older myth. It goes back, what, 4,000 years ago.
Yeah.
But and maybe the earliest myth that has ever been recorded, I'm not sure. But it also applies to this time.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that.
So the book begins quoting from a papyrus manuscript at the very beginning of making paper. Paper comes from papyrus. And someone found a manuscript where an Egyptian poet scribe, appears to be a man, is saying things like, why should I continue to live when culture is falling apart, brother is turning against brother, greedy people rule everywhere, no one stops the violence in the culture, why should I even bother to live? And I'll read it to audiences without telling them what it is, and it sounds like the PBS report on the latest news. Okay. And it's like we're going through the same thing. And then in the manuscript, his soul answers him. What they call the ba-soul, which would be like the unique soul of the person, answers and says, because he says he's thinking of taking his own life. And so the ba-soul says, don't do that. Instead, go back to the origin of your life and connect with the potential at the origin of your life and then live to the end. And then you and I will go to the other world together. And so I go on to explain that the reason I'm using that story, two reasons. One, it sounds like the same condition we're in now. But secondarily, his soul answers him. The culture at the time was very aware of the inner soul. And a modern person might not even know they have a soul. And collectively, there seems to be so much lack of soul that we're in the same condition in a way without the immediacy of knowing that the soul has answers that we need, so that we're in a worse off condition than the 45-year-old world weary man. And all of us get world weary these days.
Exactly. And so you're talking about these days, we're talking about we're in a materialistic culture. Everything is based on logic, rationality. We count the beans, so to speak. And so there is, as you posit, there is a lack of that interior, the acknowledgement of the interior in what you call the soul. Please help us understand what you mean by soul.
So, you know, it's something you can describe but can't define. The nature of it is elusive. That's part of the nature of it. But an aspect of soul is depth. It's a key aspect. So the old distinction is spirit's connected to fire and air and it rises. Soul is connected to water and earth and it descends. So soul is the descending, deepening part. If we think about the world tree, it's the roots going further down as opposed to up towards the heavens. And so another distinction is whereas spirit tends to go towards one spirit, the universal oneness, soul goes towards diversity and multiplicity like the roots of a forest or the secretly connected life of trees or something. And so soul is the connective tissue of life. In nature, it's the connective tissue called the soul of the world. And in culture, it's the soul of the individual and the soul of the community. So I'm saying when people turn against each other the way they are now, people have always opposed each other. But now if you're the opposition, you're evil. It's gone to a really big extreme and the middle is empty, not just the middle of politics, the middle where the imagination should be. So it's a kind of an overall loss of souls, what I'm saying, on the individual level and on the cultural level. And at the same time, you can't completely lose the soul. So we're in the moment of choice and change where just as everything falls apart, the soul tries to come back in with its endless capacity for vertical imagination.
So you're saying that soul or this energetic that is deeply rooted in culture and in nature and in ourselves is speaking to us more than ever if we have ears to hear. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The world-weary man could hear the soul speaking. It's a brilliant thing. And oh, by the way, there's no end to the manuscript. It's torn. So there's no conclusion. What did he do? Which is, you know, charming mythologically. And I consider him the first Hamlet. And the issue isn't to be or not to be. I don't think that's the exact question. The issue is to be oneself or not to be. That it's not a matter of existing and persisting. It's a matter of awakening to the destination that's written into the soul. And then I'm saying the problems are so diverse right now. They're so intractable. They're so enormous like with climate change, probably the biggest crisis that we're in, if people could see the, you know, the information's there, a lot of people in denial. Next level, humanitarian crisis with all the refugees, with all the misogyny coming back, the racism, the issues at the border, separation of children from families, that's all humanitarian crisis. And then the next crisis down, I think, is the crisis of truth and meaning. And if we don't solve the crisis of truth and meaning, we won't be effective working on the humanitarian crisis or on the crisis of climate change.
So you're saying that that's the fundamental that we need to address,
yeah,
the purpose and meaning, and finding that in our own lives.
And then delivering it back to the culture, which has lost the sense of meaning in life. And then look at the argument in the culture about who's telling the truth and where is the truth. And so in the book, I move towards the end of the book where I'm talking about living in truth, not just having one's truth, but living in truth. Like when someone stands up against all the power structures and just simply tells the truth of their own soul. Now, people say, well, you can't prove it, there's no evidence, but that's only one view. Is from the practical side, from the story side, the narrative mind, or mythological, the truth of one's soul has its own evidence.
So, Michael, for those who are standing up, especially publicly,
yeah,
telling their truth, and even though there's backlash, let's say, on it,
yeah,
that's possibly, in the way you look at it, it's not a throwaway. There still is reason for it, even with the backlash, and it is changing culture in some way.
It's not the end of something because it didn't fully work out. It's the beginning of something. I think it's initiatory, that we're in a double initiation. One has always been the question of the human soul. Can I awaken to what my life is really about? And can I live that honestly? And can I deliver whatever gifts I've been given in order to contribute, say, in a Dharma sense, to the remaking of the world?
A Dharma meaning a Buddhist term, which is?
Meaning serving something beyond oneself, because the soul moves beyond oneself. The soul is uniquely oneself, but if the soul is connected to everyone else, community is a collection of souls, the soul is secretly connected to nature. When a person learns their own nature, that's their connection to great nature.
So you have to keep thinking of soul as that tree, the root system of the tree. If we're the tree, the roots spread out, as you said earlier. So just keep thinking, okay, I'm not alone. I'm really connected on some deep level.
Yes, and depth is a quality of the soul. And any meaningful project, personal or collective, needs depth to be meaningful. And then I'm saying the argument of the crisis of truth and meaning, because you have people saying we're in the post-truth world, you have people in
alternative truth world.
People in positions of power say truth is not truth. Well, the soul goes, no, wait a minute. I know what truth is. Truth is a living thing. It's not an argument about evidence. That's only one simple layer of it. It's actually the living evidence of life having meaning and direction. And so the soul, I'm going back to the old sense that the soul has its own genius. The calling that everybody wants to have is to be called to something. The calling is calling to the genius, so that it could become conscious. And then once a person has the calling, they're headed for a destination. And the bigger word of that is destiny. And so sometimes a person's destiny is to stand up in public, bare their soul, and tell the truth, the lived truth. And if it happens enough, people will begin to recognize it and hear it again and understand that that's the soul speaking truth, not just to power, but to confusion and chaos. And humans are the source of that.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Michael Mead. He is a storyteller, a person, an interpreter of myths, and brings us wonderful myths in our lives to awaken soul. And his newest book is Awakening the Soul, A Deep Response to a Troubled World. And if you want to know more about his work and his podcasts and other things, his appearances, you can go to the website mosaicvoices.org, mosaicvoices.org. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. With Michael Mead. He is a storyteller and scholar of mythology and the author of Awakening the Soul, A Deep Response to a Troubled World. And Michael, in the book, one of the myths that you share has to do with the repairing and the golden repair.
No.
And this just takes me to that's your own personal story that you share so deeply in this book, your own journey into the descent to hear your own soul's calling. It was a harrowing experience, a military prison. So if you could share with our listeners a bit of that story that helps us to know your journey.
Well, I was trying to give the reader a sense of where I'm coming from and why I'm saying these things, and also give a sense of how the soul acts in a person's life in surprising ways. And as anyone who has had traumatic experience knows, it's very hard to go back into that. And I consider that those experiences indelible markers in the soul, and even though it's painful, those experiences live inside and can be tapped into. So I'm always going back to learn more from my own experience. So in this case, what actually happened was one day I'd been drafted to go to Vietnam, and I had sent a letter back saying, well, it's not a declared war, and I don't think it's a just war, so I don't think I'll come. Let me know if you have another war. And and that's him somehow waked up the FBI, who came and said, you either go to the Army or you go to jail. And I didn't know anyone else who was opposed to the war. No one in my neighborhood was. They were all in favor. So it's this kind of strange, unique, singular thing I was doing. And so I went in because I didn't want to go to jail, I guess, and because I wasn't sure. And then
you signed up. You signed up for the military.
Well, I was drafted.
You were drafted, right.
No, I never would have signed up.
You didn't actually sign up, but you actually ended up.
You do sign a paper, yeah.
Right.
So then we were being trained to go to Vietnam, and so in this one meeting, there's a captain, I think it was, giving everybody a talk on how you will sacrifice your life for the country. And that means if there's a hill and we want to take that hill and they're shooting down and you're ordered to go, you go. Whether you die or not, you follow that order. And then the second part is when we say you shoot someone or shoot in some way, then you do it. So, and I said, wait a minute, that means that I die on command and I kill on command. I raised my hand from the bleacher seats and said, I can't do that. And they said, what do you mean, soldier? And I said, I can't kill on demand, and I'm not even sure I can die on demand. And then the officer said, if I tell you to die, you will. And I said, I will not. He said, then I will shoot you myself. And at that point, I started to say something else, and I got dragged out of there. Long story short, many court-martials finally sentenced to the longest term they could give me in the military prison. Get into the military prison. It turns out they give you similar orders to that. And I said, you know, didn't you get the memo? I'm not doing the orders. And they said, okay, that means solitary confinement. And so then I'm in this solitary cell for months. And somewhere in the course of that, I realized this wasn't going to go well. And I started fasting in my own terms, against what I thought was oppression or misuse of authority.
Well, I think what I found fascinating when you talk about the fasting part, you had some realization that whatever was happening, they still looked at you as being a soldier. You were still dressed like a soldier. You were eating their meals that they were giving you like a soldier.
Exactly.
So you had some insight.
You know, I felt like I was telling them, I'm sorry, this was my fault. I shouldn't have come in. I'll go home now. I was, you know, and it wasn't working. And I realized, oh, I look like a soldier to them. And they're feeding me, and I'm accepting it, so it looks like I'm involved. So I realized I have to get rid of the uniform, and I have to stop eating. It seemed to me like almost a philosophical misunderstanding that they didn't understand that I really meant it. I was finished. This was an era. I shouldn't be in this situation. And then an amazing thing happened. Then I'm the only person in the whole military base in the entire area who's in the military but not of the military.
I mean, you threw your clothes out of the cell.
Yeah,
you refused the meals.
I threw the bedding out.
The bedding out.
I'm living all by myself in there. And then what started to happen was officers, starting with lieutenants, but right up the ranks, would come in the evening. And the guard would open the cell, and they'd step in and say, they'd give me an order. And I'd say, you know, I'm not doing orders. Don't waste your breath. And then they'd go, okay, but maybe we could talk a little bit. And so then they would start to tell me what was wrong in their life and what the pain they were living. And I became the confessor of the very people that were locking me up, I think because I was the only one around who was there but not part of what was going on. And also, I wouldn't get a haircut, and I was starting to grow a beard, and I had red hair. I think I looked a little like Jesus. And so in writing about it, I realized what happened is the archetype had shifted for me. They saw it shift too. And I was not a soldier now. Now I was like the confessor. The archetype had shifted from, the war archetype to the healing archetype. And so I would hear confessions and I would give them advice and all kinds of stuff. And for me, it was really a radical experience and hard to understand. It took me years and years afterwards to realize, you know, what had happened. And I still unpack it, which one reason I offer the story is so people realize, even if they've had a very negative life experience, there is knowledge inside there that is very specific to them. Every time we survive partly because our own genius wakes up. And I just followed my instincts and then wound up getting out of there eventually and then found out it's an old my ancestors are Irish. It's an old Irish thing to fast against authority. And that was amazing to me when I found out after I got out that I'd actually tapped into some deep ancestral memory of what you do, of one of the things you can do when you're being oppressed by a power and dominance, which is how I experienced it. And then I found out that the Irish called that ritual fasting. The Gaelic word is troscad. And then Gandhi read about an occasion of that in Ireland, and that reminded him that India had an ancient ritual fasting practice, and then he incorporated that into part of his work, Satyagraha, The Force of Truth, very similar to the Irish idea, very similar to the idea of speaking truth to power, but this goes further, sacrificing oneself to not be subject to power.
And you almost died.
Several times.
You got down to way under 100 pounds. I'm just wondering, Michael, what it was, what was that spark that even though you didn't understand fully, like looking back on it now, you know, decades later, you can see more of the full story.
Yeah.
But at the time, making those choices, how did you possibly go against your very nature and not eating when your body is crying out for food? How did you possibly do that?
I think it's the deeper nature of the soul. What happened was in that one session where they finally said what the deal was. If we tell you to kill, you kill. If we tell you to die, you die. No one had said so clearly what the deal was. Something in me, an ancient thing, the soul in everybody is ancient. And it has deep resources, it has deep philosophies and deep memories. And something in me said, there's a fate worse than death. And that fate is to die not as oneself. This goes right back to the Egyptian scribe, where the soul is saying to him, don't die now, live till the end, because there's a fate worse than death, which means to not live one's own life. And I had gotten down to this deeper level of myself where I honestly couldn't do that. I'm not saying that I wouldn't have the capacity to kill or to harm someone. If someone's attacking some innocent, unprotected person or animal, I'm stepping in.
Right.
But to actually say that I'm going to agree to do that kind of thing, I instinctively knew it was damaging to my own soul, and I just simply said, I can't do that.
One of the things that you talk about, too, like, here you are, solitary confinement. You're really cut off. But there's something, there's a companion you had with you, a numinous companion. And that was going back to your own childhood when you were 13 years old. You got that book on mythology. So you had time to kind of do what? Oh, how did that inform you?
Well, solitary confinement is quite troubling because now...
It can cause schizophrenia. I mean, it really can lead to dire situations.
Yeah. You either connect more deeply to yourself or you begin to dissociate.
Yes.
And you can do both. And so I wound up fasting for over 2 months. They would force feed me once in a while, which was turned out to be really helpful in the long run. But I didn't think I was going to live through this anyway, so I was pretty determined where I was going. And so then there's no one, by definition, there's no one there but me, except there were some beings there. And because I had studied myth, these old stories were coming back, and the characters from the myth were showing up in the cell. And so one day I realized, okay, I'm either losing my mind or I'm finding my mind. And I thought, I'm going to accept the presence of these mythological characters, because otherwise I really am alone. And so it's a little bit like the Basel speaking, the Egyptian scribe. He decides to listen. I decided to listen to, you know, Odysseus and Athena and the characters from the myth. And then I realized, oh, this is my soul. My soul, my life turns out to be about mythology. It appeared in the absolute worst moment. And that allows me to say from experience and hope that it can be meaningful for other people, under great duress, the deep resources of the soul wake up personally and I think collectively. And that's why I call the book Awakening the Soul, because under pressure, things awaken that we didn't know were there. And that's what can happen in nature too, but it happens in human nature.
So that's where the repair comes in, the golden repair. It's just like you don't negate all that trauma and all of that, but it's repaired in a golden way.
So that goes to this beautiful thing called kintsugi, which is a Japanese term for repairing something using gold. And so they have this, you know, brilliant ancient idea that when something like a valuable ceramic bowl, which they make many of, when it cracks, you don't throw the bowl away, go down, get another one, which might be the modern approach, yeah. I don't know. What they do is they take resin and gold and they fill the crack with gold so that old valuable antiques become more valuable, not just because the gold is in them, but because now gold is shining through the cracks of a broken thing. And so to me, I took that as an image of the world, that we're experiencing an increasing fracturing of the world with the divides between political parties, the divides even between genders, the divides between poor people, rich people, the multiple cracks in the world. And then I'm suggesting that what we need to do is find our own gifts and our own ways to work meaningfully in the world. And we could consider that pouring our gold into the cracks of the world.
I'm here with Michael Mead. He is the author of Awakening the Soul, A Deep Response to a Troubled World. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide.